readers, and welcome listeners to Connect the Dots. This is Allison Roslevy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. It's great to be with you each week to talk about the connection between our personal health and our total health environment, the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our society, the health of our global environment. And every week on Connect the Dots, we discuss different aspects of this with experts, advocates, authors, and scientists that really kind of bring us up to speed about all of the different things going on in our world that impact our health. Every week, I begin the show with a couple of shout-outs to some terrific activist opportunities that you can participate in. It's an easy way to kind of find out what's going on and get involved. You can also subscribe to my blog, healthjournalistblog.com, and sign up there for action opportunities via email, or follow me on Facebook at Connecting the Dots for Health. Today, I just want to highlight a few things because there's some very interesting stuff going on. Last night, I went to an event at Cooper Union about it's sponsored by Yes, Divest from Fossil Fuels, and Bill McKibben, the leading environmentalist, was a speaker there. We had a great opportunity to hear his argument for colleges and universities divesting from fossil fuel investments as part of their funding and endowment investments. So it was really great to hear not only Bill McKibben speak, the noted environmentalist, but also to hear students who are concerned and involved because they're living in the world that we're creating. They're concerned about climate change, and they're taking action by inviting their universities, and this is happening with more than 250 all across the country are organizing to invite their universities to divest these investments, which help keep the, you know, the kind of pump going on our use of fossil fuels, and hence the changing climate and weather, such as that we see in novel weather events that are going on globally. And Bill McKibben detailed that. And I've done a bunch of shows, which you can also listen to, about the connection between, for example, Occupy Sandy and climate change. If you want to learn more about this, you can listen to some of the past programs that we have from November and December of 2012 here on our archive on Progressive Radio at Connect the Dots. The other thing is there's a wonderful, a wonderful video you can watch, a live stream of the event last night. And in order to hear that and listen to and watch it, you can go to http://yesdivest.com. And that's where you can hear the entire live stream of this conversation between Bill McKibben and a range of students from New York universities who are organizing to protect life during their time of life and for their children and grandchildren. Another opportunity that you can participate in, if you're actually anywhere in the country, is to participate in the Forward on Climate Rally that's taking place this February 17th at noon, and it's a Sunday in Washington, D.C. It's been organized by Bill McKibben's organization, 350.org. People are taking buses down. They're coming from all over the country. A special shout-out to my California friend, Susan Hammond Rogers, a grandmother who's coming to walk for the sake of her grandchildren, to ask the president to start his second term with strong climate action, not just talk. Key to that, this group, 350.org, is requesting the president to reject the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline, which would only accelerate what we're seeing with every passing year, including the last, the warmest year on record, is a really growing and mounting and dangerous climate crisis. So you can go to 350.org and find out more about how to get a bus or, you know, go to the march from wherever you are, and I hope to see you there. Today we're going to be talking about a different facet of the endlessly fascinating topic of how fossil fuel use is impacting the lives of many people, not only through climate change, as you'll find out more about in those archive shows, as well as in the live stream, which I hope you'll tune into, but also directly in terms of its physical presence in communities, and where, you know, it has a direct impact on people living in different places. On Connect the Dots, I've discussed fracking a great deal on previous shows, and I also blog about it on the Huffington Post and Alternet, as well as other topics that we cover here. So, you know, there's a lot to be said about that. But I think there's a misconception that, you know, fracking is only a concern if there happens to be drilling in you know, a community far off in a rural area somewhere. Not so. Fracking and the use of natural gas that comes from the shale gas wells also is a concern. It could be a concern almost anywhere anyone lives, whether pipelining through a city like New York, which is happening, or pipelining through, you know, exurban, suburban, and other regions. These pipelines carry the gas from its, you know, drill source to anywhere, and can create community havoc. So in today's show, we're going to highlight that by speaking to two terrific advocates who have been really working hard to draw attention to a compressor station currently proposed for a place in New York State called Minisink, New York. So I want to welcome them both. Our guests today are going to be Pramilik Malik of Stop MCS, Stop the Minisink Compression Station, .org, as well as Tanyet Colon of MUST, Mothers United for Sustainable Technologies. Welcome both of you to Connect the Dots.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Allison. Thank you very much for having us.
It's great to have you here. And, you know, I have to say, I had the opportunity to, you know, interview you and get information from both of you for a recent Alternet blog on this topic, which readers can also find and learn more about it. But you're going to learn probably right from the horse's mouth quite a bit today. One of the ironies of building this compressor station is that it's being built in a town called Minisink, which is called, you know, which is well known for the number of policemen and firemen who serve New York City as service providers, you know, to protect New York, who live up there, and it's therefore called the town of guns and hoses. And as we know, these were our, you know, frontline first responders during 9/11. There are a number of survivors who happen to reside in Minisink for reasons we can discuss in the program. And with the plan to build a compressor station right in the center of town, their community, their homes, their lives are under threat to be drastically altered. And that's what your organization, Pramila, Stop the MCS, is all about. And your organization, Tanyet, really looks at the larger issue. It highlights this issue, but it also looks at the larger issue of how we maintain our world and what we have and need and want, but in a way that's sustainable for communities, for children, for the earth. So, you know, first of all, maybe you could do this, Pramila, to kind of orient our listeners, what is a compressor station? Many people may not be aware of what that is.
Okay, so, I mean, as you mentioned, all of the impacts that we talk about when we talk about fracking, the air pollution, the water contamination, the fugitive emissions, the noise, they all travel with the gas. They travel along the pipelines and through all of the related infrastructure that goes with the pipelines. And a gas compressor station is infrastructure that goes along the pipeline. It is used to pressurize the gas to keep it moving down the line. And it sounds very benign, but they're actually very large, volatile facilities. They tend to frequently blow up. They emit thousands of tons of pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. Usually when they build the facilities, they also have filter separators and storage tanks, which can cause groundwater contamination. So they're really, you know, just as bad, if not worse, than the well pads. And they're needed every 40 to 100 miles along the pipeline. So wherever that gas is going, compressor stations and, as well, metering stations are going to be built. Now, metering stations measure the amount of gas going through so that the transmission company knows how much to charge the shippers. Mm-hmm. So in both of those facilities, you have what they call blowdown events, pressure builds, and so they have to release the gas a few times a year, and that releases a massive amount of pollution into the air and greenhouse gases. But compressor stations in particular are about 10 times worse than metering stations. We already have a metering station in our town, which a lot of people didn't know when that was being built. But the compressor station, luckily, we sounded the alarm, and we've been fighting the company, the transmission company, for about 18 months now. And as you mentioned, you know, we have a lot of children who live in the town. We have a lot of 9/11 first responders with documented lung damage, some very severe lung damage, living in the town. And the irony is, yes, many moved actually to that area pursuant to the advice from their physicians that they needed to be in a cleaner rural environment in order to recover. So it is quite ironic, and the impact if this facility is built, and by the way, it is being built as we speak, but we are fighting it in court. But if it becomes operational, yes, the health impacts are going to be very severe.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, in many cases where this kind of activity is going on, because I've toured through the areas of Pennsylvania where drilling is occurring, and, you know, recently fracking has come to California where, you know, almost within a few weeks an announcement was made, then the state reserve, you know, land reserves were opened up for drilling, and now people in the L.A. area, they had a road collapse near a drilling site. So, you know, in just a 1 to 3 month turnaround, people suddenly kind of find themselves living in a new and shocking reality without kind of knowing what hit them, and then some very often the health impacts follow. And there have been many, you know, anecdotal reports of that. What's happening here that is so additionally surprising is that this is planning and being built, as you say, to occur in a place where there are already people suffering health impacts from 911. So that
right.
Instead of kind of feeling like, oh, well, maybe it'll be okay, what could go wrong, or, you know, maybe we could just coexist with this,
right.
You know, there are people who already know what can go wrong.
Right.
What do they have to say about this?
Oh, well, the first responders are absolutely devastated, and those who are suffering respiratory illnesses and lung damage, and due to the toxic exposure they suffered already, they mm-hmm. are not, you know, buying into, you know, any notion that this is, you know, benign or safe or harmless. Mm-hmm. And it's not. I mean, if you look at the emissions that by the company's own admission are coming out of that facility, you know, you have all the volatile organic compounds, the deadly BTEX compounds, nitrous oxides, hydrogen sulfide, and then you have all the heavy metals, and formaldehyde. And they admit to all of this. And I think, you know, those are dangerous enough, but then there's always this question of, you know, you have 500 different chemicals going into the ground when they frack the gas. Mm-hmm. We don't know what comes out and what stays bound to the gas. I mean, for example, formaldehyde stays bound to methane throughout the life of that compound. if we don't know what's going in, we don't know what else is coming out. So this is just, you know, the chemicals that they're obligated to identify. So that's number one. There's all of these unknown dangers. And then there's the health impacts from the noise, because these facilities produce, I don't know if you've ever been around one of them, but they produce noise like a jet engine 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we actually went, when we, you know, first discovered that this was being proposed for our town, a group of us actually went to different compressor stations in the area to see what it was like. And it was absolutely unbearable, the noise, the vibration, and it's, again, being exposed to, you know, noise like a jet engine 24 hours a day has a whole series of health impacts. There's a disease called vibroacoustic disease, which is pretty well documented. And it causes all kinds of cardiovascular problems and neurological problems and developmental problems. So, you know, if you think about the large number of children who live in the area, you know, pregnant women, I mean, it has terrible impacts on any kind of vulnerable population, which would include the elderly, children, the first responders, pregnant women, the unborn.
Let's bring Tanyette into this discussion, too, at this point. Tanyette, you know, you are, your organization, Mothers United for Sustainable Technologies, is specifically directed to mothers and families and children to kind of take a closer look at some of these practices, as well as other novel things in our world, in terms of their impact on children and families. Is this, are mothers concerned about this? Do you, in your opinion, are more people becoming kind of savvy about this, or
yes,
do you think most people are kind of still
in
denial
about
it?
I think parents are now starting to become more proactive on this issue, and many, because they're all interconnected, but people are starting to realize that obviously their environment and what they eat plays a part in not only themselves, but their children's health as well. And, you know, thankfully we have the internet today, and information can travel fast, and there's a lot of resources where parents can go to find out more information on certain topics. But what Pramila pointed out, all those chemicals, I mean, I know you know of Dr. Phil Landrigan, who's from Mount Sinai, who's a child environmental toxicity expert, and a couple of the carcinogens that Pramila had mentioned are on his, he has a list called the 15 toxic threats that put children at risk. Formaldehyde is certainly one of those toxic chemicals that is on that list. And the idea that this kind of infrastructure can be carelessly placed literally in the middle of a residential zone, 600 feet away from a mother with four tiny children, when, and Pramila will speak more to this, when there is an alternative that in a former industrial location, to me is careless, and it speaks volumes.
So it's being, you know, people will say, you know, one of the things that happens is that when people bring up environmental concerns, other people who, you know, don't care, or they're far away, or they don't see why this would concern them, you know, will say, oh, well, you only are concerned about this because it's in your own backyard, and so there's this accusation of not in my backyard, you know, as long as it's not happening to me, I don't care. And then, you know, the allied thought, which is isn't really spoken out loud, is, well, it has to be in somebody's backyard, you know,
right.
So better
right.
your backyard than mine, and therefore people don't step up to protect everybody. One of the things in the fracking community is one of their you know, lead pitches is not in anyone's backyard, you know.
Right. And we would concur with that. We don't believe that this type of facility belongs in anyone's backyard in any residential community. And in fact, I think Tanya mentioned the reckless, you know, what MiniSink shows is the recklessness of the industry, because we discovered a viable alternative in which there is no home. Now, we're talking about a community right now, MiniSink, where there are 200 homes within a half mile of this project. We proposed an alternative site already owned by the company, already had a compressor station, already industrialized, already has the infrastructure already built in. not one home within 3/4 of a mile. The access road to the facility itself is almost a mile long. It's so remote. And the company actually was forced to admit that, yes, it would meet their demands, but rejected it.
Why?
They would have to replace a portion of pipeline called the Never Sink segment. Mm-hmm. It's a 7.5-mile aging pipeline, mm-hmm. which has had a lot of problems. We've documented... we had a pipeline engineer look at their hydraulic analysis, and he determined that this aging pipeline could not withstand the pressure that they were going to put on it and could result in an explosion far greater than San Bruno. Now, we believe that they want
to explain to our listeners what San Bruno is.
San Bruno was the explosion in California a few years back. I think 8 people died. It was a gas pipeline explosion, and 8 people were killed. And our pipeline engineer, who's a very well-known pipeline engineer, looked at this analysis, and he said, this makes absolutely no sense. And it makes no sense, and they know they're going to replace that 7-mile segment. They want to be in mini-sink because it's given them the opportunity to acquire a new 72-acre property, a new greenfield property in which they can expand and interconnect with other pipelines that have already anticipated connecting into the Millennium Compressor Station. So this is like this has already been mapped out by the industry, and I think that what they're envisioning for Minisink, because it's so strategically located near Pennsylvania, near New Jersey, and in New York, is for Minisink to become an interconnecting hub. They also want to be in Minisink so they can connect to a power plant, which is being built in a nearby town. So it's a map that's already been configured by the industry and by policymakers, and they segment the project into tiny little segments so that they can evade the full environmental analysis that would otherwise be required. So that's why they presented this as one tiny little project, and we were able to expose that sham. Mm-hmm. We documented, pursuant to the company's own internal documents, that they already had these expansion plans, replacement of the Never Sink segment, additional compressor stations, and interconnection to the power plant. So we documented all of that, and we submitted it to the agency that the federal permitting agency called FERC. They still got away with it. Though we were able to get 2 FERC commissioners to agree with us and support the alternative plan. The other thing about the alternative plan that I want to state is that not only does it mean that the facility would be in a remote location with very little human impact as well as environmental impact, but it would also require a much smaller compressor station, which would result in 44% less air emissions and 44% fuel usage. And hence
44%, what was that again?
44% less air emissions and 44% less fuel usage.
Mm-hmm.
So that
mm-hmm.
means, hence, 44% less greenhouse gas emissions. So, you know, when we're talking about, you know, climate change and being serious about climate change, I mean, here you have an agency, a federal agency, and a gas company that have opted to, you know, to take this reckless path of unnecessarily burning more fossil fuels and polluting the air much greater than it needs to be,
mm-hmm.
just because, you know, there's a long-term profit motive in it for them.
Mm-hmm.
So the alternative plan is overall better for everybody. It's not in a residential area. It means less air pollution in New York State, and it means less fuel usage. But like I said, you know, they basically lie to get what they want, and the regulators allow them to lie, you know, and that's how they are able to, you know, expand and build these facilities so recklessly.
Mm-hmm. That's a terrible thing. I mean, this is unusual because, you know, whenever we face these kinds of hard choices, people will say, oh, well, what are you going to do? We need this, we need that. There's no better way to do it. you know, of course, we're not only not investing, for example, at the level that we should in building not only green energy sources, but green energy infrastructures. What we're talking today about today is an example of infrastructure. So we're not building those, but here where you actually have a lower cost alternative, you know, these sort of grand plans, even when, you know, not really owned up to completely, you know, kind of supersede the public good on multiple levels. So even when there is a perfectly fine and better way to go about it, and still kind of I think this is really it's important both for the town, but it's also not just about the town of Minisink, because it really shows that this could be happening. People think, well, it's far away, but these compressor stations, these pipelines, they're going to be going all over the place. Do either of you have any kind of insight into other places where this has happened or where it may be happening? Because, you know, my sense is we don't even know exactly where and whom this will be hitting next. You know, it starts in one thing, but then it kind of keeps going on in different locations, and it's really, you know, of concern. Do you know other places that, you know, other regions even, that will be getting pipelines now or soon in the near future?
I was going to say, I know there's a group upstate that's fighting the Constitution pipeline, and I believe there was one in somewhere near Hancock, New York, a compressor station.
But that's just in our state. What about in New England? Are there going to be pipelines there? Are there going to be, you know, is this happening in the Midwest? Is it like going to go everywhere? Is that, you know, how widespread is all of this going to be?
I think that wherever they can find shale gas and as deep as they can go, as the technology allows them to go deeper and deeper, more territories will be opened up for this extraction method. And so wherever you have shale, and pretty much most of North America is on shale, at different depths, you're going to have people wanting to drill, and then once they start drilling there, they have to get that gas to market. And market usually means urban centers, but it also means LNG terminals. And you see proposals now underway for various LNG terminals.
Can you define that for our listeners and what an LNG is?
LNG is a liquefaction. I don't know what LNG is. I guess liquefied natural gas is what it stands for. Mm-hmm. And so what they do is they take the gas and they liquefy it by cooling it at extremely cold temperatures. So they're building these liquefaction plants where they're going to liquefy the gas, and then once it's in liquid form, it can be exported. So the real goal of the industry, I mean, they talk a lot about domestic energy security, but the real goal of the industry is to export that gas. And, in the United States, this gas sells for about $3 a gallon, which does not pay for the drilling and infrastructure cost. But abroad, it sells for about $15 a gallon, and that would make it a profitable enterprise. And so all of these companies use various pretexts to get the infrastructure. Because of the Natural Gas Act, if something is for the purpose of domestic energy use, they can exercise eminent domain. They have all kinds of federal preemptions. For example, in our case, our zoning does not permit this type of facility. It's strictly residential agricultural zoning, and it does not allow for even any variance. They weren't even eligible to apply for any variance because our zoning laws are so strict about it. However, because it's considered a federal project, it was preempted by federal law, our local zoning laws.
Well, that's really shocking. You know, Pramila, I'd like to talk more about that in the second half of the show. We have to come up and kind of do our break now for station identification here on Progressive Radio. So that's a very rich topic. And stay with us, listeners. We'll be coming back I'm Allison Rose Levy for a further conversation about these gas pipelines with Pramila Malik and Tanyette Colon. Stay with us for the second half of Connect the Dots. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, with actions, experts, advocates, and information that connects the dots between our personal health and our total health environment. On today's show, we're discussing climate change. We're talking about natural gas pipelines and compressor stations and how, in an effort to achieve so-called or the myth of energy independence, we're kind of creating a lot of havoc with communities across the country. And the case in point that we're focusing on today is Minisink, New York, the town of Guns and Hoses. And our guests have been cluing us in to what happens when a pipeline and a compressor station, which are all part of the natural gas infrastructure, come to town. If you want to learn more, I want to give you some information where you can follow these events, and get this kind of information from the people who've become overnight or, after a year or more, become experts on this because their town is just one of the latest targets. So today my guests are Pramila Malik of Stop the Menacing Compression Station. That's online at www.stopmcs.org. You can go there to read more about what we're talking about on today's show in terms of the safety questions, the policy questions, the public health questions, as well as latest actions. Additionally, our guest on today's show is Tanyette Colon, who founded Mothers United for Sustainable Technologies, really promoting and raising the flag on various technologies and how they affect children and families and what parents and moms and everyone concerned about the young can do about it. Mothers United for Sustainable Technologies, MUST, is also available online at we-must.com. Both organizations also have a presence on Facebook. You can also keep tabs on this and a related group of health, environmental, and activist issues by following my website, healthjournalistblog.com, following me on Facebook at Connecting the Dots for Health. And you can also listen to this and past shows on health and the environment on the Progressive Radio Connect the Dots archives. Make sure, if you like the programs, to rate the shows on iTunes and link your friends to them as well. There's actually one of what we were discussing before our station break came in is the sad reality that all that this town will endure in terms of health and environmental impacts, loss of property values, loss of quality of life, and everything that the town is pretty much united in opposing, it could have been prevented because, as we learned in the first half hour of the show, there's an alternative site that would work perfectly well if either the company would agree to use it or the policymakers at the federal government level that oversee this would look out for the public good and insist that they do so, but that's not happening. Of course, when, new to this issue, one likely will think something like, oh my, we have to get our energy somewhere, and this is going to provide, as we've heard repeated by PR statements over and over, 100 years of energy independence. We need this, but, what you were just saying, Pramila Malik of Stop MCS in the first half of the show, is that actually this isn't going to be used very much for energy here in the States. It's not going to be giving us energy independence, you stated before we came up to our station break. It's going to be exported abroad.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess, you know, I guess economists and others can weigh in a little bit on that. But the fact is that at $3 a gallon, it doesn't make sense, financial sense. It's not profitable for them to be extracting the gas via this method, given all the infrastructure required and given how difficult it is to extract it via fracking. But at $15 a gallon, it does make sense. And there are several applications already submitted to FERC for liquefaction plants and then for export terminals. I think there's one being built in Maryland, and I believe there's a liquefaction plant being built in Maine. There's an export terminal in Louisiana, and I think there's a what used to be an import terminal in Washington State. The company is applying to change it to an export terminal. So, you know, and wherever they're extracting that gas from, whether it's, you know, the Barnett Shell or the Marcellus Shell, they're going to have to or want to transport it to those export terminals, which means pipelines will have to be built. And if pipelines are built, metering stations and compressor stations will have to be built. So the impact, the gas is coming somewhere close to probably a majority of your listeners, and the impacts will also come as well, along with the gas. That's been our experience.
I actually wanted to follow up on a couple of things that Pramila is talking about. I mean, a lot of people who have been following this issue can see that there's a lot of foreign interest dollars that are being funneled into the U.S. on projects. Allison knows that I've been to Norway, and Statoil is actually a big, you know, country. Statoil is a big company that's been investing a lot here in the U.S., in the Barnett Shale, in the Marcellus Shale, in North Dakota, in Montana. I think they just announced recently that they bought parts in they bought acreage in West Virginia and Ohio as well. You know, Norway's not the only country that is here in the U.S. There's other countries as well, because we make it easy for these countries to come in with production, and like Pramila's pointing out, those LNG stations are being built, and I even think even in Savannah, Georgia, there's proposals to put something there as well for exporting. So this is, there's a lot of international influence and implication to what's happening not only in New York State, but here in this country as well. And as we've pointed out, I think a lot of people who aren't in the immediate area that's being impacted has this false sense of security that if it were to come into our area or nearby, that we're protected. And I think the story of many things shows that even when there is a viable alternative that could avoid having this community have this form of impact, that it's in a sense being ignored in its business as usual. So my hope is with this story that people start to realize that there is no such thing as a safe zone. And I think philosophically as a society, we have to get rid of the idea that it has to happen, one. And number two, we have to stop being okay as a society here in the U.S. that it's okay to have sacrificial zones or sacrificial lambs in the name of any form of energy independence.
That's an excellent point. And in fact, you know, I highlighted that a bit. You know, the term sacrificial zones I highlighted in my recent alternate article on the Minisink compressor station, which, you know, listeners can Google and read. And that term comes from Chris Hedges in a conversation with Bill Moyer, saying, you know, what you're describing, you know, that more and more places are just being, you know, kind of sacrificed, and it could kind of happen anywhere. And what you're saying, an interesting link that you're making there, an interesting connecting of the dots that you're making there, Tanyette, is that, you know, this is happening because foreign multinationals come in, and
yes,
our government is rolling over, you know, rather than, you know, protecting us. And you mentioned Statoil out of Norway, you know, so in effect, you know, we're always talking as Americans, you know, we're the leader, we're the colonizer, we're the exploiter of resources, and we're kind of getting, this is the beginning of a turn over a decade that this has been happening, and I think a lot of people haven't caught up with the reality that, you know, this is a turn in which we become the exploited, the colonized, the third world country whose resources are taken and used, and it's, you know, covered by the myth that this is for us, and you know, everyone repeats these terms until people believe it. They were probably cooked up in a back room somewhere by some PR folks doing marketing testing and all of that kind of thing. And the reality is, you know, we are becoming the third world. So when you hear, groups organizing and you know, as has happened in Minisink and everything, you know, people will tend to kind of think, oh, well, poor them. And in our own minds, we sort of go, oh, well, okay, you know, we kind of agree for our neighbors, the people who supply needed services to our city, you know, the policemen and the fire department. It's okay for them somehow, we imagine, to be sacrificed, you know. We kind of agree to it tacitly when, you know, but as they, you know, the famous statement that was made back in the time, you know, looking at what went on in Nazi Germany, where, you know, when they came after the trade unionists, I said nothing because I was not a trade unionist. And then it goes on until it finally gets to your backyard, and then there was no one to say anything. So I think that's kind of, you know, what we're seeing here. And that's why it's better, you know, I don't live in Minisink. It's better to join forces and stop these things on all our behalves, while and when we can. I mean, I think that's kind of the takeaway here, and I thank you, Tanyette, for bringing up that kind of, you know, overarching point.
Okay.
Comments?
And I think that, yeah, I mean, I just want to reiterate that what these policymakers are missing is the interconnectedness of all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Air and water do not recognize state boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they travel, air, you know, spreads for you know, hundreds of miles. Water travels. Our aquifers are very complex. And, you know, just to bring it back to the issue of health, this project is being built on top of a sole source aquifer. That means if that aquifer gets contaminated, there is no other water source in that area for 15 million homes. It's the Wallkill River Basin aquifer, and it supplies water to 15 million homes in New York and New Jersey. So, you know, when we talk about risk to our water and risk to our air and risk to our soil from which we derive our food sources, I think that, you know, that's an impact that is going to be felt by everybody, whether you're near a facility or pipeline or not. And I'll just give you an example. I mean, Minisink is not only home to this, you know, vibrant middle-class residential community, but it also is home to a number of dairy farms and organic farms. And in fact, lots of our dairy farms provide milk to farmland milk. Now, what's going to happen when, you know, that air pollution goes into the air and comes down in the form of acid rain, gets into the soil, gets into the water, and the cows drink that water? You know,
well,
and
we know what's going to happen, and actually we did a whole show on what happens, unfortunately, back in 2011 with Michelle Bamberger and Robert Oswald, who have done some of the early scientific studies on the fact that, yes, it does get into both vegetables and dairy and livestock. And
right.
So, you know, you're down there. This is one of the reasons why I've, you know, my tagline for the show is connecting the dots between your personal health and your total health environment, because, you know, I've been a longtime champion of the organic food movement and of, you know, healthy food as foundational to health and of self-care through eating healthy food. I've covered that for two decades. And so, you know, and even to this day, I'll hear people going, oh, eat organic, and if we only planted this and that, or we should grow it in the city. And it's like, well, what is a quality of that food going to be? You know, with these kind of chemicals coming in, and you know, and again, no one has studied them in advance and said, well, will this be a problem? No, it's just kind of going forward, and then there's science is kind of playing catch up where it can to say, we now know it is a problem because people are experiencing health problems. So we don't, you know, don't let that happen to us. Now, what can, you know, listeners do? You're having an activist event, aren't you, coming up real soon? Can you tell our listeners about that?
We are having a rally in Minisink itself. And if you go to the website, you can get the details right across the street from the construction site.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark Ruffalo, the actor and activist from Water Defense, will be attending to kind of motivate and inspire our community to keep going. And it's an opportunity for people to see the impact, you know, up front. It's directly across the street from, as Tanya mentioned, the home of a family with four very young children. And
what is the date of this event again?
It's on Saturday, this Saturday, February 9th, at 12:30 p.m., and it's going to be in Minisink at 107 Jacobs Road. And again, if you go to our website, www.stopmcs.org, you can get all the details and directions. And I would caution everybody to kind of keep a watch on the website because there is some talk about a snowstorm on Friday night. We're keeping our fingers crossed that it it's either minor or it gets delayed. But we'll make that determination on Friday. But Sandra Steingraber, I believe, will also be coming, as well as some folks from Pennsylvania, from Susquehanna County, will be coming as well, which would be really, you know, appropriate because the gas on Millennium's pipeline actually comes from Susquehanna County as well.
In Susquehanna County, that's where...
Pennsylvania, right.
Yes, that's where Yoko Ono and Sean Lennon recently visited
right.
to, you know, kind of see what it's like in these regions where this happens.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So we think it's really appropriate that we have folks coming from there to follow that pipeline. And it should be, you know, really exciting to be able to meet with the families that... that have been fighting this this company for the last 18 months. And, you know, we do have a case pending in the D.C. Circuit Court. So we, you know, hope listeners support us in that effort as well. The case will be a precedent-setting case because the court will determine whether FERC and the gas industry has an obligation to evaluate impacts on communities or not.
Mm-hmm.
And to what extent community impacts are going to be factored in policymaking going forward.
That's a very important thing.
It is it's a very important case. It will have implications around the country as to how these projects get cited.
Mm-hmm.
So we hope listeners follow that as well. And I, you know, since you talked about Bill McKibbins, I just want to put it out there that we are also calling for a divestment from this company that we believe has been reckless and irresponsible. Even though the pipeline is called Millennium Pipeline, it's owned by a parent company called NiSource. It's a gas transmission company. And we are asking people to divest from NiSource as well until they start acting responsibly. And I also want to mention that they were also the owners of the pipeline that exploded in Sissonville, West Virginia, recently.
Mm-hmm.
And they have recently, just a few weeks ago, been cited for federal safety violations as well. So it's a company with a long history of safety violations, a long history of recklessness. Minisink is just, you know, an example of how they operate, how the industry in general, you know, operates. So all that information is on our website, and you can also follow us on Facebook. As you mentioned, we're at Stop the Minisink Compressor Station, where, you know, we provide real-time notification, you know, of things happening on the ground. And, we really hope people will support us and help us in this struggle, because we think, you know, Mini-Sink has implications around the country. I think that, you know, we can serve as a cautionary tale to the gas industry that small towns in America are ready, willing, and able to fight back and even win.
Well, you know, thank you so much for your efforts, and it really, you know, they're done on behalf of, you know, all of us. And, you know, so you can also, listeners, you know, attend the rally. You can support them. You can divest. I mean, there's a whole bunch of different ways that people can participate, and I, you know, hope you'll consider doing it. We have a few more minutes left here, and then we're going to be closing. So, you know, up this edition of Connect the Dots. So, you know, just a kind of a quick question. You know, for me personally, I mean, as a native New York City resident, I always kind of keep an eye on what happened to the first responders anywhere, but for 911, you know, they were touted as heroes, then their health problems were neglected. There was a huge fight in Congress to even cover some of the medical costs. You know, so people are always ready. Politicians will stand up with a hard hat and try to get photographed with them. But then, you know, when it comes to really following through and taking care of them, and we see the same thing with our veterans, the military,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
Oh, we'll go to war and, you know, we're with them and a yay team. And then they come back hurt or injured or damaged from the sacrifice they made for their country or their city. And then it's like, well, let's forget that. Now they're among the needy. Goodbye. I don't want to have to follow through on my commitment and social contract to you. And I personally feel outraged by that, because that's just, you know, to me it's unethical and immoral to do that. But, I mean, what do these folks say themselves, you know, to go up there, to breathe the clean air, and then this thing comes to their community? I mean, can, you know, like, how do they feel about it?
I think, you know, many things is traditionally a very conservative town,
mm-hmm.
but I have to say that they are really, 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 really disappointed, is putting it mildly, with the inaction of the government and our legislators. I mean, we've been asking Senators Schumer and Gillibrand for help for, you know, since the beginning, for the past 18 months, and we've gotten,
well,
you know, very little support.
And you haven't gotten much of a response. We're going to have to close out here. So let me just, you know, let's close with the words of Bill McKibben, because I think what he said last night kind of applies to this. He said, I can tell you who will take action on climate change and who won't, you know, based upon looking at what kind of donations they receive from gas and oil companies, sad to say. So, you know, some of the parties that you just mentioned there, I was thinking about, because there are the senators here in this state where this is happening, and, are our politicians even able to show up for us when, you know, they're kind of in the pocket in certain cases like this? I don't know. I haven't looked into either of these individuals, but sadly, you know, in these days, we have to be more cynical and really ask that question. Well, I want to thank you both, Pramila Malik of StopMCS.org and Tanyette Colon of MUST, Mothers United for Sustainable Technologies, for being with us today on Connect the Dots. And I want to thank you, listeners, for joining us for today's edition. Come by again next week, every Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Connect the Dots on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy.
Thank you.